sure. Is it the very last Thursday and Friday? Or is it next?
The final lab exam is during finals week, when you have your lecture exam. It's during finals week on the day that you normally have lab. So if you have lab on Thursday, you'll have the exam on Thursday. If you don't have lab on Friday, but it's final exam week. Not as your syllabus says. Syllabus is wrong. Make sure that you are aware that it's the last. The last week. It's during final exam. And it's during the regular lab. Okay, so we're going to move now through the digestive tract, beginning with the esophagus. We've talked about lips a little bit. We've talked about tooth and tongue. And now let's move down the esophagus. And it's important right now to be aware of the four layers, histological layers, that make up the digestive tract from esophagus to rectum, and there's on the first slide here the first two layers. Remember we said the term mucosa is kind of analogous to the term skin. Skin has two major layers, epidermis and dermis, and mucosa has two major layers, an epithelium and a lamina propria. The epithelium is going to change, as you saw in lab. The epithelium is going to change as the esophagus gives way to stomach and as the colon gives way to rectum. We're not going to look at the colon-rectum junction, but you will have an opportunity to look at the esophageal-stomach junction. We'll look at that here together pretty soon. But these are the learning objectives for the mucosa and submucosa, and we'll talk about these learning objectives as we look at the drawing coming up here. I just want to make one correction I see on this, and that is that when you examine the submucosa, if you had an opportunity to spend some time with it, you'll see that the submucosa is loose connective tissue in some places, but it's dense irregular in other places. It's not the same all the way through, and it can vary even within a single organ. It can vary right in the small intestine from loose to dense. So it's not just loose all the way, and that's very clear in the microscope slides that you looked at, hopefully saw it last week. So we'll try to find all these things now as we progress down through the GI tract and where are the other? Okay, so what we see in this drawing from Juan Chiara then are the five layers. The mucosa consists of an epithelium and a lamina propria. Where's the lamina propria labeled? I guess it's labeled right here. And that's loose connective tissue for sure. Part of the mucosa includes the muscularis of the mucosa. This is Latin for of the mucosa. So muscular layer of the mucosa includes three components then. An epithelium, whatever that might be, a lamina propria, and the muscularis mucosae. Some mucosa is found external to the mucosa, or the word sub is kind of ridiculous because it would be sub here in the drawing, but it's not sub there, it's above. So it's a kind of stupid word. Sub means underneath. Actually, it's external to the mucosa, and it's either loose or dense depending upon where you're looking. Other two layers are shown here, and are they labeled as well? They're labeled in this fashion, an inner circular layer, and where is the outer longitudinal layer? Right over here. So these two are the two components of the muscularis externa, an inner circular and an outer longitudinal. They constitute the muscularis externa, And then the outer layer is either an adventitia or, in this case, serosa. And you might ask, well, what's the difference? Serosa generally is a very thin membrane, like smooth, shiny surface. But the adventitia, in other places, above the diaphragm, is rough and woolly, like a cashmere sweater or a woolly sweater. It's got a rough surface on it. So the esophagus is above the diaphragm, and so the esophagus does not have this smooth, shiny, silky, saran wrap-looking outer surface. The outer surface of the esophagus is rough and ready. It's got collagen fibers sticking out all over the place, and it is not at all smooth. What makes the smoothness of the serosa? Well, a layer called the peritoneum. Peritoneum is something that you're going to be looking for extensively in gross anatomy in the second quarter and in the winter quarter. A peritoneum is a specialized connective tissue that contains cells that for years and years have been called the mesothelium. And the danger of that word is that it suggests that it might be an epithelium, because it's got thelium in it. The peritoneum is the layer made up of cells called mesothelial cells, or mesothelium. Again, we have mesothelium, you see it up there, is the name given to the cells that make up this layer called the peritoneum. And this a similar layer of cells surrounds the lung. And there it's called pleura. But the mesothelium in the abdominal cavity is called the peritoneum. That same kind of cells in the thoracic cavity around the lung is called pleura. So that means then that in pathology, a malignant tumor of the pleura is called mesothelioma. If you ever watch television, and this lawyer advertises, I can make big bucks for you because you may have been exposed to asbestos. If you have a mesothelioma called Sokolov, that, you know, all this number. Mesotheliomas are tumors of these cells, and the most common one is around the lung. So people exposed to asbestos in naval shipyards or wherever it's been removed from houses that are exposed to asbestos could develop a mesothelioma, keeping in mind that it could be in the peritoneum of the abdominal cavity. Almost never would you find a mesothelioma there. So these are specific cells, and they are connective tissue cells, not epithelial cells, but they look like an epithelium, so somebody called them that. Now you'll notice that in the small intestine here, the mesothelioma, the mesothelial cells, or the peritoneum, if you wish, this layer surrounds the small intestine and then reflects upon itself in the posterior body wall. So let's draw that here a little differently than we see it. The peritoneum covers the outside surface of the small intestine and the colon, comes around here, and it's a loose connective tissue, comes around there, and then reflects back up like this, so that we have, if these ends work properly, we have this tube, like so, where the peritoneum, the epithelial cell, wrap all the way around the outside. And then
man.
And you see it. You see what happens is you get two layers of peritoneum that come together, and this structure is the famous mesentery. Got any better ones over there? Maybe monitor this. And in Gross Anatomy, you'll be finding the mesentery in both the abdominal and pelvic cavities, and see how it specifically covers over all the organs. There is no peritoneum above the diaphragm, and therefore there's no peritoneal covering for the esophagus. That has tremendous clinical implications, because the peritoneum has nerve fibers in it that are pain fibers. But the adventitia lining the outside surface of the esophagus doesn't have any pain fibers in it. And so a tumor of the esophagus can grow huge. A malignant tumor of the esophagus can grow huge before it's detected by pain. But the tumor in the abdominal cavity can nearly grow as big as that, because the patient will feel pain due to the fact that they have a nerve-filled peritoneum around the small intestine and on the surface of the stomach, front and back of the stomach. Okay, so the second layers then are, of course, the muscularis externa, which has an intercircular layer. Oh, by the way, I forgot one thing. We need to recall, and I don't... Oh, yeah, it is listed here. We need to keep in mind that there are some neuron cell bodies. A little nerve plexus, that is called, in the submucosa. There's another one here between the inner and outer muscle layer. So we got two nerve plexuses for you to keep track of. The one that was seen easier in lab is the one that's embedded in the muscle layer. So that's what we're talking about here. The submucosal plexus has nerve fibers from a preganglionic autonomic nerve fiber. And you'll also find some beautiful cell bodies of neurons of postganglionic neurons. Remember, the autonomic nervous system requires two neurons in a chain, a preganglionic and a postganglionic. And so we asked you in lab to look for those cell bodies of the postganglionic neuron, parasympathetic, actually. You can't really very easily see the preganglionic nerve fibers because they're too small. We also see that the submucosa in some regions has some important glands, and the one that jumps to mind right now as an example of a submucosal gland are the glands of Brunner, or Brunner, however you want to pronounce it, Brunner's glands, which help you identify the duodenum and distinguish it from the jejunum ileum. So one example of submucosal glands, among many, is a very important one in order to help you identify the duodenum. Okay, so muscularis externa has two layers, an inner circular and outer longitudinal, unless you're in the stomach. And the stomach has three layers. It also has an oblique layer mixed in, but we're not going to expect you to look for it. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Because the stomach needs more muscle in order for it to do its job. What is the job of this muscle? Why is it there? What is the word?
Peristalsis.
Peristalsis, right. It's there to move food digestive tract, and that movement is called peristalsis. Moving food along the digestive tract. And the muscularis mucosae probably contributes to it in ways that are not very clear. And of course, there's a nerve plexus between the two layers. And again, there will be a mixture of preganglionic nerve fibers. Some of those are, some of them are sympathetic and some are parasympathetic. All of the cell bodies you see, every one of them in the gut wall are parasympathetic. But the nerve fibers, preganglionic nerve fibers, could be either of those. So peristalsis is the term. Serosa is the outer layer in where there's peritoneum, and it's called the adventitia where there is no peritoneum. Adventitia surrounds the esophagus, and it's generally loose connective tissue. And where the serosa is found, you'll also find that the organs are held in the abdominal cavity by mesentery. Remember Hannibal Lecter? Remember him? Remember that movie Bowels In or Bowels Out? Remember that? Standing up in the library. Why didn't the bowels fall down on the ground? Because they're held by a mesentery. They can't fall out of the abdominal cavity because the mesentery holds them at the back. Okay, and it's made up of a layer. It's made up of a layer called the peritoneum. The peritoneum is made up of cells called the mesothelium.
I know, but
Rachel?
It came, like they unraveled, like what came from, or like hanging in the balcony.
Mesentery. Question: what's the difference? The mesentery is two layers of peritoneum and runs from there to there. Two layers of peritoneum. The peritoneum is the entire covering of the bowel plus two layers in the mesentery. Mesentery has two layers of peritoneum. Mesentery runs from the bowel wall to the back, to your back. And it contains blood vessels and nerves that reach the bowel through that little narrow passageway there. I don't think Ross has a picture of the peritoneum here, or mesentery. Well, it's got a kind of a funky mesentery here. But I guess you could think you see that it's two layers, probably. I would ask you to look this over, and at first glance, it comes from your textbook. At first glance, it looks cluttered and almost unintelligible. However, if you take your colored tools from lab and start coloring the mucosa, and then color the submucosa, and put different colors in your PowerPoint hard copies, you'll see that it's a very useful drawing, and it compares esophagus, stomach, small intestine and colon from top to bottom. And one of the things that hopefully you emphasized in lab was that when you compare these organs, the major differences are in the anatomy of the mucosa. The anatomy of the mucosa, including epithelium, lamina propria, and muscularis mucosae. And once you study that in lab, from esophagus to colon, then everything else looks about the same, except, of course, that in the duodenum, you have Brunner's glands in the submucosa. What's in the ileum in the submucosa that distinguishes the ileum from the rest of the small intestine? Higher fatty. Okay. So you have to look at the submucosa a little bit. Here's a drawing of the esophagus, and you'll note, and you probably already noted, that the epithelium of the mucosa of the esophagus is stratified, squamous, non-keratinized. Unless you're a rat, one of your slides is of a rat, maybe it's a possum, I don't know. But they eat everything. So they have a need for greater protection there. But we have a moist, soft, stratified spinning disk. Why does it appear convoluted like this? What do you think about that? It's collapsed down because there's no food in it. It's collapsed down, and they're trying to make the drawing representative of what it would look like in a normal histological preparation, and so part of the reason for this folding here is the elastic recoil at the time of death. And otherwise that epithelium would not look like that in a normal esophagus. For example, if somebody went to a gastroenterologist, they might show a little fiber optic tube down the esophagus and look around with the fiber optics. They're not going to see a star-shaped lumen. It's going to be nice and round lumen of the esophagus because it hasn't recoiled down. It's still perfectly cylindrical in shape. Okay, the only other thing that we probably should say about the esophagus is that the upper one-third has skeletal muscle in the muscularis externa. Actually, we didn't ask you to look for that, or did we? We did ask you to look for that in the slide. Didn't we? Okay. We're not going to test you on that anyway. However, upper one-third muscularis externa is supplied by skeletal muscle. So each muscle cell, then, in the esophagus here, receives an axon. And that axon arises inside the brainstem from a component of the vagus nerve. So the axons to skeletal muscle run all the way from the central nervous system all the way to the muscle cell. In the lower one-third, all the cells are smooth muscle. How many neurons does it take in sequence to supply smooth muscle? Two. Remember that story? If you don't, you'll be tested on it. Well, even if you don't remember, it could still be tested. Anyway, remember the concept. Skeletal muscle cells are supplied. There's a skeletal muscle cell out here. Are supplied by a single axon from a cell in the ventral horn going to the ventral root, terminating in a neuromuscular junction. Smooth muscle cells require two neurons in order to reach the target from smooth muscle cell. What's the first neuron called?
Preganglionic.
And what's the second one called?
Postganglionic.
That is an inviolable, absolute law of neuroscience, that we have these two neurons in a row. So that means that the smooth muscle of the esophagus is supplied differently from the skeletal muscle. So a neurological lesion in the brain could result in paralysis of the upper end of the esophagus, but not the lower end, or vice versa. A specifically strategically located lesion in the central nervous system could cause paralysis of the lower part of the esophagus and not the upper. And that obviously has some clinical relevance to it. Keep in mind, again, the upper one-third has skeletal muscle, and the lower one-third has smooth muscle. How about the middle one-third? What do you think about that? No muscle at all, or what? If the upper one-third is skeletal and the lower one-third is smooth, what do you think about the middle one-third?
Both.
Smooth and skeletal muscle. And here's a scanning electron microscopic view of a cross-section. And it does show this artifact of the mucosa having this collapsed appearance. Also a little artifactual is the submucosa, because when the mucosa collapses, it kind of pulls apart the submucosa. And so here, a microscopic image of this area would show connective tissue that looks very loose because it's been pulled apart a lot. Other areas it will look dense. And of course, the muscularis externa is here, submucosa is there, and the mucosa is in lines of lumen. Esophagus is located in the mediastinum, as it's called, mediastinum. And that mediastinum is a gross anatomy term that refers to the compartment found between both of our lungs. The region where the heart is found, the region where the esophagus is found, the region where the aorta is found, between both lungs. And it perforates the diaphragm, and you'll be finding that spot. The esophagus perforates the diaphragm in a region called, in a hole called the hiatus. Oh, red tree. Hiatus is the hole in the diaphragm that the esophagus passes through to reach the stomach. If the stomach partially protrudes, abnormally protrudes through this hole called the hiatus, what do we call that? Hiatal hernia. Anybody have a hiatal hernia or know anybody that has a hiatal hernia? You'll encounter many, many people in your practice that have a hiatal hernia named after the famous hole in the diaphragm that the esophagus passes. So how is the esophagus related to the pharynx? Well, it's related to the pharynx in terms of the fact that the upper one-third muscularis has the same muscle fibers in it. The pharynx and the esophagus, the lower end of the pharynx, has skeletal muscle supplied by the vagus nerve, and the esophagus has skeletal muscle. But that soon disappears and is replaced by smooth muscle as we begin to descend through the mediastinum. So we get to the diaphragm, and where the hiatus is, the esophagus has smooth muscle in its outer wall. And mucosa stratified, squamous, non-keratinized. There are some submucosal glands, esophageal glands in the submucosa. But they're not useful for any diagnostic purposes. They're not useful for you to identify the esophagus, because you're going to identify the esophagus by looking at this. It's the only portion of the gut wall other than the rectum that has stratified squamous epithelium, and we're not going to look at the rectum in class. So it's the only digestive tract organ that has stratified squamous epithelium. Muscularis externa, upper one-third is skeletal muscle, lower one-third is smooth muscle, the middle section is mixed. Both. Nerve supply is through the vagus nerve, both skeletal and smooth, but the origin of the nerve fibers is different for the skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. Different site of origin of the axon. What becomes extremely important in pathology class next year is to remember that at the lower end of the esophagus, as the esophagus passes to the diaphragm, esophagus is coming down and passes through the diaphragm by going through the hiatus and then joins to the stomach. And right below the diaphragm, not in the stomach yet, there's a small section of the esophagus in the abdominal cavity. Most of it's in the thoracic cavity. There's a small section in the abdominal cavity. And somewhere right here is a sphincter What is a sphincter? Something that closes off, closes off. And the most famous sphincter in the digestive tract, well, we got a couple of famous ones, but one famous one is the pyloric sphincter right here, which closes off and allows the stomach to churn and mix the food, and then that pyloric sphincter opens. We have one here, too, but we can't see it anatomically. In the pyloric sphincter, we got a huge mass of muscle here. Extra muscle that forms a big annular ring. But up in the lower esophageal sphincter, there is no such anatomical structure that would even let you know that there's an important sphincter there. And it's called the lower esophageal sphincter. We also have an upper one up here, upper esophageal sphincter. However, there's no reason for us to talk about it because there's no clinical pathology that's known to be associated with the upper esophageal sphincter. Most of the disease of the esophagus, the bulk of disease of the esophagus is concentrated in the region of the lower esophageal sphincter. And over 90% of pathologies of the esophagus are all concentrated there. Why do we have it? Why would you expect a functional shutting off at some point in time of the lower end of the esophagus? So that your stomach acid doesn't burn the hell out of your esophagus. And when it does do that, when that stomach acid does regurgitate up here because the lower esophageal sphincter is pathological, what does the patient complain of?
Heartburn.
And we call it gastric reflux disease. Gastroesophageal reflux disease. And when you get in the clinic, you will encounter the term GERD. Gastroesophageal reflux, and it's even on television. Right now, you look carefully at commercials on television. Sounds like I watch television every day. Don't really do that. I love to watch the commercials. What happened? No, because there could be some other reasons for the heartburn that might be related to some pain associated with esophageal cancer. But most heartburn is exacerbated. Some people complain of heartburn, they probably have a very small vital part. You might want to think that we could call a cardioesophageal sphincter, but it's not. There really isn't any other name that I've encountered for that sphincter. Like down here, for example, this is called the pyloric sphincter, but we don't have a comparable name for the other one. No, the cardioesophageal junction is right here. And there is no specific sphincter. There's a transition point. The cardioesophageal region is right there. And for the sphincter, I'm talking about it's up high. That cardiac esophageal region doesn't have any function like this at all. And then, of course, there's adventitia on the outside of the esophagus, which I guess we didn't see on these pictures here. I suppose they're labeling this adventitia out here, I guess, a little bit out there.
Can you tell us what GERD stands for again?
Gastroesophageal.
What's gastro mean? Stomach. Esophageal. Esophageal. Reflux. Disease. Gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Is all heartburn Hartford comic like that, though? Because I thought people seem to sometimes just go to the case of chronic or whatever reason to make it sound like it's always chronic because there's a pathology to this.
Individuals with hiatal hernias will always have heartburn off and on, not continuously, only when they're eating food and the stomach has to contract and then the acid burps up into the esophagus. If they're not eating food, they still have the pathology, but they're not having any heartburn.
It's like on commercials for different types of over-the-counter medicines for that, they're always like,
a miracle, right? Yeah, a miracle. There are a lot of medications, both over the counter and under the counter, I guess, that neutralize the acid or have some effect of preventing a whole lot of acid here, which would reduce the heartburn. The problem is the pathology still exists.
Heartburn
and what?
Yeah,
we'll talk about in pathology class. We're not going to get done with this if we continue on here. But the peptic ulcers are going to be here or down the duodenum. And you can tell the pain of an ulcer by how long it takes the food to get there. So you can time it. If the pain follows a meal 30 minutes after the meal, and then the pain disappears when you eat food, then you can bet it's a peptic ulcer. The peptic ulcer will hurt about 30 minutes after the meal, and if you eat more then it'll go away. The peptic ulcer down the duodenum, the pain there develops about 90 minutes after you eat, because it takes a while for the food to get there. Now, the pain of a gastric peptic ulcer could be very similar to heartburn. The pain of a duodenal ulcer has a major time lapse. Good. And if you're wondering about yourself, that's one thing. But when you get into Fizz Quinn, you'll go through that in detail. That's a little premature here. Definitely. Let's move on. In Arishenko's atlas, we see the histology of the mucosa, the submucosa, the muscularis externa, and the adventitia out here. And that looks like smooth muscle. So that must be the lower one-third of the esophagus. I hope you look for the myenteric plexus in here, neuron cell bodies. Anybody have trouble finding the muscularis mucosae in the esophagus? Boy, then you are good. You are good, because that is a cutter. The muscularis mucosae in almost all other regions of the digestive tract is beautifully well-defined. But look what happens in the esophagus. In the esophagus, it looks like the lamina propria and the submucosa are continuous. See the little chunk here, and little chunk there, and little chunk here, and little chunk there, and little chunk there, and little chunk there, and it doesn't form a nice smooth layer. And if you haven't looked at it yet, beware of that fact. Don't get so terribly frustrated, because some of the slides don't show the muscularis mucosae at all. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. Once you get below the esophagus, it'll be a piece of cake from then on. Here's a very nice high-powered view of the stratified squamous non-keratinized. How do you know this is non-keratinized? Because you have nuclei all the way out. There's nuclei in this little cell right there, and there's a nucleus in there. That's non-keratinized. Notice that in stratified squamous, like in the skin, another feature is the upsies and downsies of the basement membrane. Up and down, up and down, up and down, like over here too. It goes up, down, up, down. None of the pseudostratified doesn't do that. Simple columnar doesn't do that. No other epithelium has the up and down thing like that. There's some submucosal glands over here in the esophagus. We don't put a lot of emphasis on that because it's not useful for much of anything. Did you all, some of you hopefully saw the junction between esophagus and stomach. Is this stomach here or is this esophagus here?
Esophagus.
Esophagus. And what's over here then? Stomach. How do you know? Because the esophagus is stratified squamous. Do you believe me? Up and down and up and down. And the same thing with the epidermis of your skin. It's up and down business. Now this goes up and down too, but slightly differently because it goes down a gastric pit and into a gastric gland. And then the basement membrane goes up again. So it's a little different here because you have a smooth surface out here with little holes in the stomach mucosa, little holes that don't look like holes, but they are in fact round holes that are called gastric pits, and I have a better picture of them. Hopefully I have that better picture of that as we proceed through here. Okay, stomach then. We all know the shape of the stomach from all kinds of drawings. Seen almost everywhere, in our doctor's office, in our high school health book, even on television. What's the shape of the stomach? Well, it has a so-called greater curvature on the left side of the stomach, and it has a lesser curvature on the right side. This is a lesser curvature there, and a greater curvature out here.
We could also say concave and convex.
Yes, no one ever does that, but it certainly is true that that's the convex and that's concave. But only in a two dimensional
line. What about a line between two?
A convex should be. Convex here and concave there, sorry. The other way around. What are the main regions of the stomach? How many had a chance to see that lab? Nobody? Some of you? Okay, cool. The cardia is a small region of the stomach that gives us fit and laugh. It's right here. It's a very small region. And fundus is the part that's found above the attachment of the esophagus, and the fundus is in contact with the diaphragm. The fundus of the stomach is up under the diaphragm, not in contact all the time, but it's up under the diaphragm. It's the region of the stomach above where the esophagus attaches. Now, all of these lines I'm drawing here are purely arbitrary. There's no surface or inside boundary that you would be able to recognize that would tell you where one starts and the other begins. And that's true for this arbitrary line down here, too, where we draw from the lesser curvature to the greater curvature. And this region of the stomach is called the pylorus. And what's left is the body. So we have fundus above, and fundus and body have the same histology. The mucosa is identical. And so the glands here are sometimes referred to as fundic glands, but really these glands, gastric glands, are found in both the fundus and the body. And of course, the pylorus is the distal end of the stomach. And I put an arbitrary diagonal line here to show the separation of body and pylorus. Now, even though you can't see a separation here, you can recognize it with a light microscope because the glands of the pylorus are very different than and the glands and the body and the fungus of the stone. Do you remember anything about the glands and the fundus and body? What particular cell would be found there?
Parietal
cells and
sheath
cells making acid and pepsin. That's not true of the pylorus. There the glands are mucus secreting glands in the gastric glands, and when you look at the glands either in cross-section or longitudinal section, cross-section here, you'll find that the cells are very pale and the nuclei are crushed down near the base of the cell, and the cells stain very, very pale-like, and you remember that's reminiscent of a mucus acid.
So then, what's the difference between the fundus and the body?
No difference. The fundus is a gross anatomy term that refers to the part of the stomach that lies above the attachment of the esophagus. The histology is absolutely identical. It's just a gross anatomy term. And here we see the fundus, which I can draw an imaginary line here. And the fundus is part above this attachment. The cardia is a small region. It's not even worth dealing with, hardly. And this is, of course, incorrect, isn't it? What should that have been labeled right there? It have been labeled body. That's horrible. Give up their pain for this one. Anyway, what are rooting? The folds in the what? The folds of what histological layer? In the body. The mucosa. Folds of the mucosa. And even some submucosa in there.
How would we recognize cardia?
Cardia will be recognized by the fact, and we'll see it here in a minute, that there are very tiny glands in the mucosa with just an occasional parietal cell. And so the slides in your collection are pretty good that way. They do show the cardia as a region with very, very small glands with an occasional parietal cell. The difference between cardia and fundus and body is extraordinarily dramatic. We'll see that here shortly. The other thing we should say about the pylorus near the pyloric sphincter is that the pylorus region contains some cells that are very, very interesting that are sometimes called G cells. And G stands for hormone. And that hormone was one of the first hormones ever discovered in human beings and maybe animals. And that hormone is called gastrin. Gastrin is primarily secreted by cells in the pylorus, not in the body, not in the fundus, not in the cardia, but down in the pylorus, and secretes a hormone that activates parietal cells and sheath cells. So down in the pylorus, one of the first hormones that we're going to discuss in this class is gastrin, secreted here, and it activates the parietal cells and sheath cells up in the body and fundus. Now, how does it do that? Well, it's a hormone. It goes into the bloodstream. It travels down to my toes and up into my ears and up into my brain and everywhere in the bloodstream. But where are the target cells?
All right.
What a stomach. What a waste of time. You were a gastric molecule. Why do I have to go all the way down to the toes? Why can't I just go to the stomach and activate the cells that I'm designed to activate? In other words, I'm emphasizing the fact that a hormone, when it's produced, is passing through the bloodstream. Wherever the blood goes, the hormone goes. And it's an endocrine cell, isn't it? In fact, it's called a neuroendocrine cell. Because gastrin, these cells secrete neurotransmitters in addition to gastrin. That's a very important cell. So here's the supposedly cardia of the stomach. And The slides you have will show far fewer glands than this drawing shows. The general rule of thumb is if you have a nice perpendicular cut, if you have a beautiful perpendicular cut of the cardia, the gastric pits should pass halfway down to the muscularis mucosa. Or another way of saying it is the gastric pits occupy half of the thickness of the mucosa. The mucosa runs from the lumen up here all the way down to the muscularis mucosae, and you'll see that the gastric pits from here to here are about half that thickness or even more. Now, what are gastric pits lined by? They're lined in the stomach. They're lined by simple columnar epithelium that secretes mucus. Don't call them goblet cells, please. And why not? Because they're not shaped like a goblet. Mark called goblet cells goblet cells because they look like a brandy snifter. They look like a goblet. But not these. These secrete mucus, but they're not goblet cells. They're simple columnar epithelium that secretes a lot of mucus. But below the red line is the region of the mucosa where we find the glands. And these glands are, in fact, tubular glands. Simple tubular glands that might branch a little bit, but they're a simple straight tube that coils like a snake. And so therefore you can see cross sections and longitudinal sections all in the same region because the tube passes down and coils like a snake, and the knife goes through it and cuts part of the snake as it's laid out and part of the snake as it's coiled. It's a simple tubular gland, and in the slides in our collection, you're going to see a few parietal cells in here, but other than that, they look like just conventional, simple columnar epithelium. A tough one, actually, and so I don't really like to ask cardia the stomach on the lab final because it's just too insignificant, really. Now, when we get to the body and fundus, body here or fundus, again, I can see that the artist has drawn only the mucosa because here's the muscle of the mucosa and up here is the lumen. So the mucosa then extends from the surface all the way down to Marilyn Monroe, MM, muscularis mucosae. And you'll see that in the body and fundus, the gastric pits occupy one third or less of the thickness of the mucosa because the glands are tremendous. The tubular glands are very long and extensive, and so these gastric pits become small. Just to say it again, what lines the gastric pit? Simple columnar mucus-secreting cells. What forms the glands down here in the body and fundus? What are the cells that make up the glands? Not goblet cells.
Parietal and chief?
Parietal cells and chief cells, right. Parietal cells and chief cells make up most of the glandular epithelium. You throw in a simple columnar cell now and then. But that's a very heterogeneous population of cells. It's a very mixed bag of cells. Up here they look all the same, lining the gastric pit. But then we enter the gland. And all of a sudden we see these big bulging parietal cells and the little chief cells lining the epithelium of the gland. Pylorus, gastric pits generally, this is a rule of thumb now, gastric pits generally are very deep. And you can see in the drawing here, they occupy almost two-thirds. A little over half anyway, about two-thirds of the thickness of the mucosa, and that leaves the pyloric glands down here looking almost like the cardia, and that's the confusion. Are we looking at pylorus, or are we looking at cardia? There's no confusion here, and you'll see that in a second. Absolutely no confusion. But we're not quite sure sometimes as a student whether we're looking at the pylorus or the cardia, and so we're going to look at some real pictures rather than this, but the pylorus, and not the cardia, the pylorus has these mucus-secreting cells down here in the glands that make it very obvious that you're looking at the pylorus. So let's look at some of these sections in a minute here. I guess first of all, though, we should talk about some physiology, not by a little, terminology. When the food enters the stomach and mixes with the gastric juice, the end product is called chyme. So the food that enters the stomach from the esophagus mixes with the acid contents and all the secretions of the gland, and that product is called chyme. And so it's this stuff, chyme, that squirts into the duodenum. One of the basic functions of the stomach, well, formation of chyme, which doesn't amount to much more than just mixing the food with acid. What's the role of pepsin? Anybody? Protein? To break down fat?
Nope.
How about sugar? Nope. Breaks down protein. And it doesn't do a very good job. But it does break down big molecules into some smaller units, not ready for absorbing yet. What's the role of hydrochloric acid in the stomach? To kill bacteria, maybe. To cause heartburn, maybe. But generally, we think of the role of hydrochloric acid in the following way. The chief cells in the glands, the chief cells in the gastric glands of the fundus body, secrete a protein into, well, let's do a different thing here. Let's draw the chief cell this way. And this chief cell secretes a protein into the lumen of the gland. And this protein is called pepsinogen. And every time you see the suffix ogen, that refers to an inactive substance, in this case, inactive enzyme. And that pepsinogen has to be converted to pepsin, which is the active enzyme. That conversion only becomes effective if the pH of the stomach is between 2 and 3. In other words, the hydrochloric acid is a cofactor in the conversion of pepsin into pepsin. Without hydrochloric acid, without parietal cells in the stomach, we get no digestive enzyme called pepsin form. It doesn't form. Now, hydrochloric acid is necessary for that conversion. Parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid, and so I'm going to draw a parietal cell here right next to that chief cell. Put a big old nucleus, and we'll put another parietal cell up here. There is the nucleus there. And you'll notice that it's a fiery pink. Well, in some specimens, it's fiery pink. And it's very puffy. And it's pH producing because it secretes hydrochloric acid. It's constantly producing hydrogen ions. And the way it produces hydrogen ions is it combines carbon dioxide with water, producing hydrogen ions, plus bicarbonate. What is the enzyme necessary for this reaction where carbon dioxide plus water yields hydrogen ions and bicarbonate? Carbonic anhydrids. Carbonic anhydrids. And where did you see this reaction before? In the bone. In what cell in bone?
Osteoclast.
Osteoclast. Same reaction that goes on in osteoclast. There the acid breaks down the mineral bone. Here, the hydrogens combine with chloride ions to form hydrochloric acid. Those same cells secrete something that's probably equally interesting to naturopaths. Allopathic doctors could give a hoot. Well, they don't really, but you find it much more interesting than allopaths, because this cell also secretes a substance called intrinsic factor. And so, let's quickly go back one slide before we take a break and find this. Find these parietal cells somewhere in here, these big puffy ones here. They're not labeled, are they? Big puffy ones, they should be rounded. Those cells secrete hydrochloric acid into the gland, which then percolates up to the gastric pit and gets up into the lumen and mixes with the chyme. Those same cells secrete intrinsic factor, gets into the gland, goes up, and joins in the chyme. What's the function of intrinsic factor? And what happens when people don't have it? If people don't have it, they become vitamin B12 deficient. Intrinsic factor binds vitamin B12 so that we can absorb it down in the ileum. Intrinsic factor made by parietal cells binds to vitamin B12, and then down in the ileum, that allows for the ileum to absorb it. So individuals that have chronic gastritis and chronic loss of parietal cells are going to be vitamin B12 deficient because there's an absence of intrinsic factor in their stomach. Gastrin is secreted by the pylorus and it activates the parietal cells and chief cells. And there are a few other enzymes in the stomach, but it's not such an important topic for us in here. It will be in biochemistry and physiology because the stomach does make a few other enzymes that aren't really of extreme importance to us. Let's take a break. Sorry.
Activates parietal and chief cells in the body from this channel and lets you in all the body. It's called a neuroendocrine cell.
That's very well.
That's cool. I can search my nerves.
The what?
That
thing?
Was so cool.
Go back.
Okay. Activates parietal and chief cells in the body. Activates parietal.
Neuroendocrine cell.
It's a neuro. That is so cool. How did it find it here, though?
Yeah.
That is so cool. No laptop, right?
And Wednesday, tomorrow, we'll undoubtedly begin the section on liver and pancreas. Now, the liver is a huge topic. huge topic, not only histologically, but biochemically, and physiologically, and pathologically, so forth and so on. So we're going to do a really good job with the liver here in histology, so that you can integrate that information later on next year to better understand liver disease. But you have to bring with you in pathology class your understanding of the biochemistry of the liver and the physiology of the liver, and then we put it all together, hopefully, anyway, put it all together in pathology class. We also have reason to understand the histology of the stomach, and so let's continue on here. Remember now, we talked about three different regions of the stomach mucosa. Three different regions of the stomach, the cardia, which I don't care if you know anything about, the body and fundus, and the pylori certainly are very, very important topics. Because I don't know of any disease of the cardia, but I sure know a lot of diseases of the body and fundus versus the pylorus. We have specific diseases of the pylorus, we have specific diseases of the body and fundus, there are no specific diseases of the cardia.
When you look at stomach cancer, what areas
are you seeing? Well, when we get to stomach cancer, we're going to see about four or five different variations to that. In one form, that's a high frequency in Japan, the cancer permeates the entire thickness of the stomach wall. But in the United States, the common sites are near the lesser curvature. But again, it could be anywhere. The highest frequency near the lesser curvature. So, in order to understand the histology of the mucosa of the stomach, you have to have some sort of sense of what's meant by the term gastric pit. And we talked a little bit about the fact that it's a depression in the mucosa, and this mine shaft of the gastric pit is lined by simple columnar epithelium. And when you fall down that gastric pit, as a little tiny person, you run into down below, you'll hit bottom, well, you might not hit bottom, you run into the gastric gland. If you fall down the gastric pit, and down there, if you're in the body in front of this, you'll have a whole lot of acid, and your feet will rot off in the opening into that gastric gland. Okay, so the gastric glands are deeper than the gastric pit, and the gastric pit is lined by simple columnar epithelium. How about the glands? Well, some of the glands cells are columnar, but many of them are odd shaped, like the parietal cells are just blobs. And so we don't really refer to the glandular epithelium as simple columnar because there are so many different shapes. That's probably not true for the pylorus, where the glands certainly are made up of simple columnar epithelium. But it's not really true for the glands in the body and fundus. Now, here is a complication. When we looked at lamina propria, in fact, we better go back and do that. When we looked at lamina propria in the esophagus, it was pretty simple. The lamina propria lies right next to the epithelium in a nice straight layer. And if you can find the muscularis mucosa, so much the better. Lamina propria was in here, but notice the muscularis mucosae. Oh, that's not right. I didn't notice that before. The muscularis mucosae is kind of intermittent. So here's the lamina propria. There's muscularis mucosae. And this lamina propria simply follows the base of the epithelium. Now let's see what happens to that lamina propria in the stomach. Lamina propria is coming along here, tooling along as loose connective tissue, and we get to the stomach. And now it's lamina propria is here and here and here and here and there and there and there. How do I know that's lamina propria up here? How would you know that that's lamina propria up there?
It
Because it's doing what? It's touching the epithelium. What touches the base of the epithelium along the entire digestive tract? Lamina propria. Whenever you see this highly cellular, loose connective tissue, and it's touching the epithelium, then you write lamina propria down on your lab test final paper. Lamina propria. But you notice how complicated it looks there. And that complication extends the rest of the way through the gut, all the way through the rectum. Boy, what a mess. Look at that. Mess, mess, mess. Okay. So lamina propria, where's the tissue space? Well, the lamina propria is part of the tissue space. And well, how do I know that? Because it contains collagen. It contains fibroblasts. It contains connective tissue. Therefore, it's the tissue space. Where do we look for the lamina propria? Here's how I would answer that. We look for the lamina propria right up against the epithelium. In the esophagus, the epithelium can be stratified squamous, but in the stomach, it's what? A lumbar stomach. Right up against the epithelium. And another picture from Ross, and I think it's worthwhile mentioning that when you look at some of the stomach slides, you have a hard time seeing the lamina propria down in the glands because the glands are so tightly packed. The drawing here, this would be lamina propria. This would be lamina propria. That would be lamina propria. This would be lamina propria. That would be lamina propria. What's this? The lumen of the gland. That's outside world, isn't it? That's outside world, free world. But this is lamina propria over here. And, but, you see, in some of the specimens, the glands are so tightly packed together that the only place you can really see lamina propria is adjacent to the gastric tips. Maybe you notice that. If you haven't, go back and check that out. The parietal cells are kind of drawn relatively poorly here. They don't look at all like alligator teeth. They look more like a round puppy. A round puppy cell. Let's stand up here at the green arrow. Stand up there at the green arrow and look down at her feet. And we're doing it in the next slide. We're standing up above, looking down at our feet, mm-hmm. and the arrow is pointing at the openings to gastric tips. And boy, you didn't get that impression from looking at this picture, did you?
No.
Boy, isn't that odd. Now, this picture here, this drawing here, would be a slice across gastric pits going that way, taking a knife and cutting down in. So now we're looking at the openings, and there's a hole here and a hole here. Here's some mucus coming out of there. A hole here, and higher magnification shows a hole with a little mucus or a little secretion. I'm not sure if it's mucus, but a secretion coming out of the gastric pit. And these are all simple columnar epithelial cells on the top. And where were they at? There are these cells there. We were looking down on that over here. And there they are here. All of these cells are those tops of a simple columnar epithelium. Compare these two back and forth until you have a good sense of the three-dimensional nature of a two-dimensional drawing. Cardioesophageal junction, well, esophagus stratified squamous, and where's the stomach? Down here, simple columnar epithelium, that's a pretty poor picture, isn't it? Right about here, I guess, is the cardioesophageal junction because the stratified squamous ends, and off the screen here is the simple columnar epithelium of the stomach. Fundus of the stomach, gastric pits, puny little depressions, like a dimple in the face of Kirk Douglas, you know, little tiny dimple there. Is it here or is it here? No, it's here. Little tiny dimple and huge, long gastric glands full of parietal cells and chief cells running all the way down to Marilyn Monroe. And what's that layer there? Muscularis mucosae. And that's the mucosa. And just tell me, hugely thin mucosa compared to the rest of the GI tract. SM, what? What's SM here?
Submucosa.
Looks pretty thin, doesn't it? At fundus and body, the gastric pits in the fundus and body, very shallow. Right here is where the glands begin. And boy, it's hard to follow those glands. Because the cells aren't simple columnar. The cells are all different weird shapes, and the lumen is very hard to find, so don't be too concerned about it. I can see the lumen here, though. It's right there. A little white spot there. And here's the parietal cells. I can't get over how Becky Love referred to these in years past. It's just an incredibly good description, and that is they're pink, puffy, pH producing parietal cells. Pink, puffy, pH producing, pH producing. Two P's there. Ooh. Parietal.
I like alliteration.
So that's what they're like. They're pink and puffy. They're chubby. They look like hamster cheeks.
Hamster cheeks.
Anyway, I think Arishenko's drawing really is very useful because it emphasizes the high eosinophilic nature of the parietal cells. Doesn't matter that they're concentrated here more than here. That's irrelevant for us, anyway. But there are a whole lot of parietal cells in the fundus and body, only an occasional one in the cardia. And notice the nice, definitive muscularis mucosae, which is the inner, you might say, that or the outer boundary of the mucosa. And what's this down here?
Submucosa.
Mucosa.
Glands,
well, the glands go by different names in the mucosa of the stomach. Those in the cardia are called cardiac glands. Doesn't matter if we're not really concerned much about it anyway. Pyloric glands are in the pylorus. And in the fundus and body, you sometimes see the author calling them fundic glands. Other authors call them just gastric glands, and that's horribly confusing, isn't it? Because they're all gastric glands, and so that reference of gastric glands is certainly confusing. It might be better to call them fundic glands, but then you forget about the body, so we call them fundo-body glands. That would work, because nobody ever does that.
Write that on the test, we got it good.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What a great what well, different you know. Epithelial cells are found in the mucosa? Well, let me just rephrase that. What epithelial cells are found in the mucosa? And they're different than in the gastric glands and in the stomach glands. And so the surface of the stomach, the ones we saw in that scanning electron microscopic three-dimensional picture a while ago, are certainly columnar epithelium, but they're mucus cells. And those mucus cells can be seen down in the gastric glands. And here's a great question, isn't it? Why are these cells of our stomach so important? Let's look at them again so we don't forget about it. There they are. Why are these cells facing the lumen of the stomach so important for good health? Why is this mucus so important?
Provide a barrier for the acid.
Because it forms a barrier that prevents what?
Acid.
The acid from digesting your epithelial cells. Remember, the pH is 2, And that acid is tough, and the pepsin is tough. And so we don't want to digest the epithelium of our stomach, and so these cells make a nice thin layer of mucus that somebody up here called, Aaron, what's your name?
Kellen.
Kellen. Kellen called the mucus blanket, or the mucus barrier. Mucus barrier. Give me the name of a bacterium that chews apart the mucus barrier and causes stomach disease. Helicobacter pylori that chews apart or digests the mucus layer, or in many, it's got all kinds of tools for doing this. So the mucus barrier is disrupted, and that can lead to peptic ulcers then. So that's an important question right there. Why is this mucus so important? Forms a mucus barrier. Oh, there it was right in where she got it. She read ahead.
Did.
Way to go. Good deal.
Come on, Eugene.
Well, what do chief cells manufacture? Be careful with this question. Now, I'm going to be very persnickety here. What do chief cells make? Pepsinogen. Do they make pepsin?
No.
They make pepsinogen. And then that pepsinogen is converted to pepsin in the lumen. What do parietal cells manufacture? Hydrochloric acid and an intrinsic factor for vitamin B12 absorption. We also have in these gastric gland epithelium, everywhere apparently in the stomach, we have these neuroendocrine cells, and they go by a whole lot of names, and here are some of the names that you'll encounter next year in pathology class. But we're going to call them neuroendocrine cells in histology, and these can be found almost anywhere in the gastric glands, and I think the artist here that drew this one had identified some somewhere here. There we are. Let's find it. Neuroendocrine cells. They can be found peppered through the epithelium, and they secrete stuff. They secrete endocrine stuff. And where does that stuff go? If you're a neuroendocrine cell here, you got two choices. You can send the stuff out here in the lumen, and it goes out through the rectum. Well, good, that'll do. What good is that? So we're going to put the hormone from this cell in this direction. And what do we find over here? Blood vessels in the tissue space. And so the hormone goes in the opposite direction of the other cells. Now, if we're talking pylorus, then we have some specific neuroendocrine cells there that secrete gastrin. The neuroendocrine cells over here secrete other things that is not gastrin. But gastrin is concentrated in the neuroendocrine cells of the pylorus.
Gastrin activates
this cell here and that cell there so that we can digest our food. So let's see what happens. We go to Kid Valley. Anybody been there?
No.
There's pizza. I wish I had some Kid Valley hamburger on it there.
Oh.
We go to Kid Valley.
Oh.
And we pop a little bit of this rotten hamburger down our gullet. And when that hamburger gets into the small, into the stomach, the G cells of the pylorus secrete gastrin, which causes all this to pour out a bunch of secretion so we can help to digest that protein. So if you have a big protein molecule, the more the pepsin acts to break it up into fragments, you start off with a big, long protein molecule here like so. And as pepsinogen is made and hydrochloric acid is present, then pepsin starts to break apart this big, long protein in several fragments. Now we had to start out with one. Now we have three pieces. The more protein fragments that are found in the stomach, the more gastrin is secreted. The more protein fragments you have, the more gastrin is secreted. The more gastrin is secreted, the more protein fragments you have. The more protein fragments you have, the more gastrin. What kind of a feedback mechanism is that called?
Positive.
Positive feedback loop, right? It's not an inhibitory negative feedback loop. It's a positive one. And how does it stop? When the stomach empties. When the protein disappears, then the G cells say, time to rest. Until the next Big Mac comes along there, or whatever hamburger you eat. Protein, heavy protein diet causes an increased production of gastrin. Rochelle. In the pylori. A neuroendocrine cell are one of the neuroendocrine cells that are found in mucous membranes. We also have these cells, we didn't talk about them, we also have these neuroendocrine, well, we did. We also have these neuroendocrine cells in the pseudostratified epithelium of the lung, in the trachea. Well, but they don't secrete gastrin there. Because they're not associated with digestion. Here's our parietal cell, and there it is. There it is. That famous reaction that's going on in our oceans and acidifying our coral reefs in our ocean. It's going to take about 5 million years for that to happen. They don't tell you that. You know, they say it's going to happen tomorrow, right? Well, there's no carbonic anhydrase in our ocean. And so this reaction is going to take several thousands of million years to happen. But oh well. Somebody won a Nobel, not a Nobel Prize, but some sort of Emmy Award for that.
We get that Emmy in the Actors Guild.
I'm a Democrat, too. You know. Anyway, there's the problem. Pylorus of the stomach shows these very pale, here's the gastric pit, but very, very pale glands, and the nucleus is very dark and sits right up against the base of the membrane. Here's another, oh, beautiful here, look at that. These nuclei are plastered against the basement membrane. And these are mucus-secreting cells, very pale. They're not goblet cells, but they're just as pale as goblet cells. And once you've seen the pylorus, truly seen it in this fashion, you are not going to miss this on the final exam. You can zero in on those glands in the mucosa of the pylorus you've got to make. Another name for these neuroendocrine cells, one we'll use next year, is aphid cell. And why all these names? And I don't know the answer to that. Why all these names? It's easy to understand what neuroendocrine means. It means that the cell is secreting a hormone, and the cell might be secreting a neurotransmitter. So that's simple. When next year, when I call this an aphid cell, you have no idea what that means. What does A stand for? P-U-D, and we have no reason to talk about that right now. But why do we do this? Because medical doctors refer to tumors of these cells as aphidomas, not neuroendocrinomas. That's too long. Take a breath halfway along. Neuroendocrinomas are called aphidomas. The same thing, same cell, just a different name. But look at all the different cells we talked about here. We talked about the surface lining cell. We talked about the mucous cell, which are about the same. Now, here's the parietal cell. What's wrong with this picture?
It doesn't look like that.
What's wrong with that?
Pink and puffy.
It's not pink. It's not puffy. Screwed up. Like pink or puffy? Well, they use a different stain. It's only pink with eosin. And here are some of the other chief cells, and there's the endocrine cell. We didn't distinguish between mucous neck cell and the surface cell. They're really pretty much the same thing, so we didn't make that distinction at all. What's unique about the outer layers of the stomach wall, the submucosa? Not much. I can't think of anything. Looks like the esophagus, the submucosa. Muscular is external. The only difference is there's three layers of muscle rather than two. And that is an oblique layer. So big, bulky, heavy-duty muscular is external. And it has a serosa. Nothing unusual. Nothing particular that you want to focus your attention on and laugh, really. We're going to start the next section. Sorry.
It's a really long day.
Wait for next quarter. When every day is like this. But we won't have at the end of the day. We will have somebody like Dr. Love. It's super exciting.
Yeah.
I'm going to need it. Maybe otherwise. I'll sleep every night. You're going to have to like throw shit at me.
Well, so how do you study?
Digestive himself.
Like, how do you study at all?
You don't.
Okay.
Just learn it in class. You have to.
Next topic is small intestine. And
like,
what are the three regions of the stomach that we have to know? Cardia, well, he's not going on the other one. Body and fundus and pylorus. How about the small intestine? What do we have to know there? Duodenum, the jejunum, the ileum. Right.
Not people know the mantra stuff.
That's
cool words, isn't it? Okay. I'll take that down for later.
All
right. Everyone's like
small intestine. In terms of function, what do you know right now about the difference in function generally between stomach and small intestine?
Breakdown
absorption.
Which one absorbs? Where do the enzymes come from mostly? Where do the enzymes come from mostly for the small intestine to engage in digestion? A very small number of enzymes from there. Think about your 20 feet of small intestine all packed in here. How's that possible? Well, in me, it's understandable. You got it. I can get 20 feet in there.
It's called
and,
like a brain.
And what? Where does all the digestive enzymes come from that allows that small intestine to digest carbohydrates, proteins, and fats? The pancreas makes the bulk of the enzymes, dumps them into the duodenum, and starts digesting our food. Well, it starts on the stomach, really. But the stomach doesn't absorb much of anything except aspirin and alcohol. AA.
Oh.
Aspirin and alcohol.
That's a bad combination.
But the small intestine, digestion and absorption are the general features. But the enzymes are made mostly, some in the brush border, I agree, some in the brush border, but most of them are made in the pancreas. So the chyme dumps out of the stomach through the pyloric sphincter and now enters the stomach, and we've got to do something right away in order for digestion by enzymes to work. And what is that thing we have to do?
Get rid of the acid.
We have to eliminate the acid because trypsin and chymotrypsin and pancreatic lipase and amylase will not work at pH 2. We have to get the pH to 8. So that's one of the first objectives, is to neutralize the acid so that the digestive enzymes made in the pancreas will work. Otherwise, we can't digest or absorb food correctly. And we'll talk about diseases of that nature next year as well. So digesting most of our carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, and then absorbing the nutrients. And we have to know about the duodenum and the duodenum and ileum. What structures are major landmarks? Well, the pyloric sphincter is the junction between the stomach, well, it's part of the stomach, and the duodenum. Pyloric sphincter, we drew it a little while ago, is a muscular, big, bulky, muscular part of the lower end of the stomach next to the pylorus of the stomach. And then at the other end of the small intestine, the small intestine joins the cecum, which which is the first part of the large intestine. And there, the small intestine attaching to the cecum. Cecum hangs kind of down as a little pouch here. And the ileum here joins to the cecum, and there's a little kind of a semi-valve called the ileocecal valve, which kind of regulates the flow, not nearly as effective as the pyloric sphincter, but a little bit of a valve there that kind of slows down the dumping into the large intestine there. By the way, the appendix hangs and dangles right down there. Appendixes.
Which does what? There.
And, of course, the small intestine is coated by peritoneum, and that peritoneum forms two layers as the small intestine attaches by a mesentery to our posterior body walls so our bowels don't hang out. This peritoneum forms a mesentery, and in that mesentery, in this mesentery, it surrounds the bowel here at the field in the center. This mesentery is the route by which arteries come in and veins go out to supply blood to the entire small intestine. Mesenteric arteries and veins pass through this narrow passageway called the mesentery to reach the bowel. Blood supply of the small intestine is something a topic for gross anatomy, so I don't expect you to know that right now. But you will have to know the names of the arteries and veins. Obviously, you knew that because it's Alioma's court, so you would definitely have to know the name of every structure. Anyway, a lot of things. What structures aid in increasing the total surface area? Why should we be concerned about the total surface area of the mucosa of the small intestine?
Absorption.
What happens if the surgeon cuts out 3 feet of your bowel?
You lose weight.
Then you lose weight. less absorption. Lose weight. You have less absorption. How about a person with Crohn's disease? Every month they go in and remove another 2 feet of bowel. So you got 20 feet. So you go in 1 year and remove 2 feet, and then the next year you go in and remove 2 feet, and the next year you go in and remove 2 feet, and pretty soon you don't have enough surface area for adequate absorption of food. So we want you to think about what sort of anatomical structures provide this massive surface area of the epithelium of the small intestine. And one of the first things that we might mention is that when we look inside the small intestine, we're going to find that the mucosa is thrown into folds. The mucosa is folded up like an accordion. Just imagine this accordion. If you take the box, you squeeze it, the billows fold up, and then you take the accordion and you let it out, and the billows flatten out. So if we accordionate the small intestine, we emphasize those folds. And those folds are not artifacts. They are real things that enhance the surface area of the small intestine above and beyond the 18 feet. And then we have intestinal villi that also increase the surface area. And we have microvilli brush border, which increase the surface area. And we have 18 feet of bowel. So when we start looking at the pictures Wednesday, tomorrow, we're going to emphasize which part of the histology of the small intestine is allowing us to have this huge surface area for absorption. 18 feet of bowel is relatively insignificant because when you add up the circular folds and the intestinal villi and the microvilli, that surface area for digestion becomes logarithmically increased to hundreds of feet of surface area for absorption. So we're going to stop here then. We'll start thinking about that.